Welcome back to Western Kentucky, a birthplace of steel. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe.
You know, Chad, of all the things that make up modern life, I think you could make a very good case that steel is the most important.
Wait a minute. Okay, so more important than plastic?
Yep.
What about silicon? No silicon, no computers, no iPhones.
Well, no steel, no plant to make those iPhones, no trucks or trains to get parts to the plants or the finished product to you. No steel, no space program, no satellites carrying your data, no landing on the moon.
Okay. So how do we get steel into the manufacturing process or infrastructure or the moon? We don't just wave our hands and say some sort of magic words.
No, we don't. We get it from outer space. Iron, Earth's most common element. Born a fusion in the core of a very hot, very large star. Its creation consumes the core, leading to a huge explosion, a supernova. The iron is thrown into space, some of it clumping with other materials to form asteroids, comets, moons, and planets like ours. It's even a vital part of our blood, carrying our body's oxygen. And we've worked iron into tools, jewelry, and weapons for over 4 millennia, refining it into steel 1,000 times stronger for almost as long.
But just refining iron ore into usable iron isn't easy. And steel, it's even harder. It takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of labor. And today we use huge furnaces operating at really high temperatures that were impossible just a century or two ago. So how did our ancestors make iron? How did they produce steel even?
Wait a minute, Chad. Are you asking me the riddle of steel? Once giants lived in the Earth, Conan, and in the darkness of chaos they fooled Crom, and they took from him the enigma of steel.
No, I mean how iron and steel production just began.
Oh, right. I have this film, a U.S. Bureau of Mines documentary from 1946.
A crude furnace was made of clay with the top open. Through the top, the furnace was charged with charcoal. To cause the fire to burn more freely, an air blast was provided by bellows made of flexible animal skins. Elevating the upper part of the bag permitted air to enter through a hole in the top. After it was inflated, pressing down on it forced air into the furnace through hollow wooden tubes. By operating the two bellows alternately, an air blast was maintained. When the furnace had been heated sufficiently, iron ore was scattered over the burning charcoal. Inside the furnace, gases from the glowing charcoal, which is mostly carbon, gradually drew oxygen from the iron ore, leaving metallic iron. In time, it was discovered that by reheating the hammered iron, it could be worked more easily. But occasionally, the repeated reheating and hammering produced unexpected results. Sometimes the resulting metal was a remarkable material, neither soft nor brittle. It had entirely different properties. It was hard and tough, yet malleable. What happened was that during the heating of the iron in the charcoal and subsequent hammering, the iron absorbed the correct amount of carbon from the charcoal and became a form of steel. With steel scientists and engineers working as a team, ever striving for new methods, new products, and new uses, it can be confidently predicted that steel will continue to be the backbone of our civilization and our progress.
Okay, but what about iron and iron production here, like in our region in Western Kentucky?
Well, I asked Dr. George Kippett about that. He's the chair of Murray State University's Department of Geosciences. And when I emailed him with the pretty short extent of my recollections from undergraduate geology class, he sent back a sort of snapshot of just how iron ore came to be in the Between the Rivers region.
The iron ore formations of Western Kentucky are mainly of Mississippian age, when shallow seas washed back and forth over this region. The Mississippian period covers a time from approximately 320 to 360 million years ago. The main form of iron ore in western Kentucky, and especially in the land between the lakes region, is a form of iron ore called limonite. Compared to other commercial iron ore regions, the western Kentucky deposits are small in scale and thickness.
So when did we get talking email, Todd?
Since Dr. Kippett came to the station to speak to you and offer a little more detail.
Well, the geological history of western Kentucky is quite interesting. For much of the past hundreds of millions of years, there's very good evidence from the limestone rocks that are very abundant here that western Kentucky and a large part of central North America were covered by shallow seas. The fossils and the rocks that are left behind are very clear evidence of that. The way that these iron deposits formed, it is believed, is that erosion from the land washed iron-bearing particles and minerals into these seas, and a variety of geological processes happened to concentrate them into small beds or layers. The way it gets concentrated is at the bottom of the seas, which aren't very rich in oxygen, the iron sort of migrates, and then when it comes in contact with oxygen water, it has been concentrated in these nodules or layers.
According to Frank Smith's book, Land Between the Lakes, the first humans to find these iron nodules and layers were Native Americans. Then the white settlers who came to far western Kentucky after the American Revolution discovered it. In fact, they began building iron furnaces in the 1790s, but...
And I guess there's always one of those buts.
Yep. Smith writes that what they called Cumberland ore wasn't the best quality. It worked for settlers' needs, and it was easy to come by, but forget doing anything else with it.
Okay, so how does iron industry come out of that?
Well, they dug a little deeper, and they found the good stuff.
The good stuff.
Well, the better stuff. And before you know it, boom, there's a fledgling iron industry, a dozen or more furnaces scattered around the region.
But what did it look like? Fortunately for us, there's still a way to find out. The Home Place 1850 is a living history museum in Land Between the Lakes National Recreation Area. And Jonathan Farrell works as an interpreter of history there. He does a little bit of the work with iron himself.
The furnaces in this area started, you know, around the early 19th century, late 1700s, early 1800s, and that's when the iron was, the iron industry first began here as a commercial trade. A lot of folks from the Northeast were finding that there was good ore here, there was good limestone, and a lot of hardwood timber that was required to make the charcoal for the fuel for those furnaces. So a lot of entrepreneurs at that time started out up in the Northeast and migrated to this area because of the opportunity that was here, and the land was a little cheaper here at the beginnings. Side industries that came along with the iron, you know, were fluent here as well. They were making pig iron, but they were also rolling pig iron into sheet metal, making bar stock out of sheet metal and metal roofing, metal guttering, all iron, of course. And of course, your nails, the nail presses at the time could press 100 cut nails a minute versus a blacksmith that could make 3 a minute on a good day. So those side industries moved in as well. You know, your tools, wood cook stoves, kettles and cooking equipment, plow parts of all kinds. So there were quite a few furnaces here making that raw pig iron that was manufactured into those objects. And a lot of that pig iron was shipped overseas. The boiler makers in London, England claimed that the iron that was made here was some of the best in the world for making boilers, steam engines. They claimed that it would hold rivets better and it would not blow up under pressure. So it was some pretty good stuff, apparently, and actually had an opportunity to work with some of the iron that was manufactured here, a piece of antique iron, at different times in my life, and it is very good quality. You really put this area on the map, that's for sure.
And into this part of the map entered Pittsburgh native William Kelly in 1847, John Neal Boucher's 1924 book, William Kelly, A True History of the So-Called Bessemer Process, says he studied metallurgy at the Western University of Pennsylvania, now the University of Pittsburgh.
Boucher goes on to write that instead of becoming a scientist, He went in on a dry goods store with his brother John. When their warehouse burned down, though, they decided to strike out for Eddyville, Kentucky, of all places, drawn there by cheap land and easy-to-reach iron ore. The pair bought a furnace from Mr. R.L. Cobb. He purchased 14,000 acres of ore and timberland and went into the iron-making business.
And at some point during those early years in Eddyville, Kelly Sumway somehow invented a new and more efficient way of taking iron ore and refining it into steel, a way far less energy and time-consuming than it had been for our ancestors.
And how did he do it, I hear you ask?
Good question. They say that necessity is the mother of invention. Lyon County historian and retired educator Odell Walker tells us that one of the stories floating around about Kelly's innovation shows that sometimes it's just a happy accident.
Now then, there's a lot of stories that are told about William Kelly, and most of them are reasonably true, but there are some that have been passed down by mouth. Many, and perhaps the majority of the things that Kelly did can be documented and verified, but along the line there were some little stories that slipped in, and one of those was that he noticed one time that by accident the furnace had been overloaded or something, and some of the molten iron filtered out over the top and cooled. And according to the story, he took his sledgehammer, and just with one hard stroke, he expected it to be broken off, because the cast iron or the pig iron, very brittle. It'll break almost like glass. But he didn't get it the first lick. So he hit it on the other side, and still. So he had to hit it several times to break it off. And he concluded from that story, if that story be true, that if you could force air into the molten metal, that you could make a shortcut to making steel. Well, he worked on that for a good long time.
Despite Kelly's studies and experience, when he floated the idea of using air blast to refine iron into steel, people weren't too sure. Well, they were sure that it was dangerous. As to why, we turn to the late Dr. Mark Moseley. After working on the Manhattan Project, Moseley practiced medicine in Eddyville for over 40 years and was a dedicated historian. In a 1976 recording, he tells us why Kelly's neighbors thought this newfangled process was a bit dodgy and what they proposed to do about Mr. Kelly.
His first idea completely exploded. You see, it blew up, you know. It didn't kill anyone. I don't think there's any casualties. But somebody got the idea that he was crazy. Just, you know, off his rock. Well, now, his father-in-law was James Nelson Gracie. He called the most prominent physician of Eddyville to examine him. Now, who he called was Dr. George Huggins. I believe if the old doctor hadn't been a native of an iron-making community, if this old doctor had said to his Mr. Gracie, said, I believe this guy is really off his nut. I never did hear of anything like this ever working. So, you know, sometime an inventor can be so eccentric that something can flip, and he might do something terrible, or might just quit. Do you say what I mean?
Well, now that Kelly was certifiably sane, his fellow iron masters began to take him a bit more seriously. And even though Kelly's steelmaking was just a sideline in his iron production, it had some potential.
Sounds like things are looking up.
It does, doesn't it?
Ah, but you see, this is where we introduce an antagonist into the plot, or more specifically, the antagonist, a giant figure looming all the way from over the Atlantic Ocean from England. Dun, dun, dun. Sir Henry Bessemer.
Of the Bessemer process, you say? The process that's uncannily like Kelly's?
The same.
So
Kelly's conflict with Bessemer begins.
I see what you did there.
Why, thank you. And you'll see, too, when Western Kentucky, a birthplace of steel, returns.
Everybody get a...
This is Western Kentucky, a birthplace of steel. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe.
So, Chad.
Yeah?
Why are we listening to Blurred Lines?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Not only is it one of my top five favorite songs, kidding. this song came out in 2013, and it was a big hit, a huge hit.
Yeah?
But very controversial. Not just the video, not just the message.
Right.
But the song itself.
Okay, explain.
So you see, the estate of the legendary singer Marvin Gaye filed a lawsuit that same year against the songwriters of Blurred Lines, Pharrell Williams and Robin Thicke. They allege that Blurred Lines sounded an awful lot like this song. And the court agreed. Now, the writing credits and the royalties include Marvin Gaye.
Okay, so bring us back to Iron and Steel in Western Kentucky.
You got it. Okay, so let me introduce you to the man you could say is the 19th century version of Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams.
He was one of those, I suppose, a bit of a cliche, but one of those self-made men.
That doesn't sound like a man to me.
Good ear. Actually, that's Dr. Susan Mossman talking about British inventor Sir Henry Bessemer. Mossman is the leading expert on Bessemer at the Science Museum of London.
All right. Now, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica, Bessemer was born in the UK in 1813 and was a prolific inventor.
Yep, right again. He was a self-taught metallurgist who invented a streamlined process to create a gold paint with bronze powder. And more to the controversial point, he's known for a steelmaking process quite similar to William Kelly's.
Very particular. He really was... also very secretive, because when he invented this process for gilding metals, gilding materials, he literally set up a factory in London, but he hired his own close family to run it. And it was extraordinary. They used to come in street clothes and then change into other clothing inside the factory. And then part of the factory, for example, the bloke who was running the steam hammers and all of that sort of material that was used for the process was in a separate room from the other people doing part of the processing. So they never knew what each other were doing, because he didn't patent the process, because he said, well, once I patented it, it's out there and I'll lose my commercial edge and people will copy me. So he just kept it secret for over 30 years. But he was very persistent, and I think he looked at things that were going on around him. So he was inventing machines for things like rolling metals, rolling steel, for things like sugar presses as well, because he thought he'd looked at the sugar cane industry and how they were processing, refining sugar. He thought it was very, very inefficient, and he produced another mess for that.
Okay, Todd, brace yourself. Here's the hook. Going back to the Blurred Lines controversy, William Kelly is our Marvin Gaye, and
Sir Henry Bessemer is our Robin Thicke. So if I understand this analogy, Bessemer got the idea for his process from William Kelly?
Maybe. Well, we need to be clear here. There is no direct evidence supporting the claim that Bessemer stole anything from Kelly. But there may be some precedent with a touch of circumstantial evidence, and we'll have more on that just a little bit later. But first, it might be helpful to understand their conflicting claims if we put it in a format that people here in the 21st century might understand. The 24-hour TV news cycle.
Mr. Kelly, we'll begin with you. Could you describe for us the nature of this dispute?
Dispute? There isn't one. I was experimenting with this method of making steel in 1851. And 5 years later, this Bessemer fellow comes along with a suspiciously similar process.
Sir Henry, your response?
Well, yes, I did indeed develop this process back during the war in the Crimea in 1853 or 1854, if memory serves. But I can assure you, your viewers, and Mr. Kelly, that my invention...
My invention?
My method came about quite independently of Mr. Kelly's work.
Tell me, Sir Henry, is there any difference, fundamentally, between your steel refining process and Mr. Kelly's?
Ah, I'm glad you asked. You see, my converter, the vessel in which cold air is introduced in the molten iron, has a pivot allowing it to...
Bull hockey. Saying his converter is different than mine because of a blasted hinge is like saying that we both invented a bicycle and his is different because his seat is higher. Nonsense.
Sir Henry, Mr. Kelly has a point. What was your inspiration for this method?
I was in France experimenting with firing elongated shells from guns, thereby increasing their accuracy. The French guns were made of an excellent quality of iron, but they had difficulty bearing the strain of the higher amounts of gunpowder necessary to fire these new shells. I determined then and there to do whatever I could to improve the quality of the iron used to make artillery pieces.
Mr. Kelly, what about you?
It was an accident, really. Some molten iron overflowed my furnace near Eddyville and was exposed to the cooler outside air. It ran down the side of the chimney, and once it cooled off, I went to knock it off with a sledgehammer. But it wouldn't break off. See, it wasn't wrought iron anymore. It was stronger. The colder air had caused a chemical reaction, burning off more of the impurities. No, it wasn't iron anymore. It was steel.
And I really must say that I in no way deny Mr. Kelly's innovation. I simply perfected it.
All by his lonesome.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean, Mr. Kelly.
Well, when I was performing my experiments, before their Crimean War, I might add, people came from all around, ordinary folks and iron masters. Some of them, I know for a fact, were English. I even had a couple of English employees who up and vanished one night after I got my pneumatic process close to perfect. They ran out so fast they left their paychecks. I tracked them to the Eddyville Wharf, down the Cumberland, up the Ohio, all the way to New York City, and then to a steamer going back to Great Britain. And then a little while later, Sir Henry comes along with a way of making steel that looks a lot like mine. Mighty big coincidence, if you ask me.
Is that an accusation?
I'm just asking, what are the odds of that happening? Unlikely, in my opinion.
Sir Henry.
Forgive me, but I'm a rather bit shocked that Mr. Kelly would say such a thing. I concede that it's highly unusual.
Unusual?
Mr. Kelly, please, let Sir Henry respond.
Thank you. Yes, highly unusual, I grant you. But I give you my word as a gentleman that I have never traveled any farther from English shores than the continent. I have never been to America, and I certainly do not know anyone who's worked for Mr. Kelly, nor have I myself ever done so. Preposterous.
Still, Mr. Kelly's patent on this pneumatic process, as he calls it, has been given precedence over yours here in the United States.
Well, yes, and justifiably, I'm sure.
Justifiable indeed. I provided piles of evidence to show the patent office that I invented the pneumatic process years before Sir Henry. They simply affirmed the obvious.
Hmm. Well, gentlemen, it certainly seems as though we're not going to resolve the controversy today. Still, I thank you both for speaking with us.
Much obliged.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, so this obviously never happened, but I'd like to talk about that circumstantial evidence you mentioned earlier.
Okay.
Remember that book we mentioned a little earlier?
John Boucher's biography of William Kelly?
Yeah, there's this story in there that takes place a few years after Kelly's U.S. patent on his pneumatic process had been given precedence over Bessemer's. Some investors in Detroit, Michigan, decided to start making steel using the Kelly process, and knowing that Kelly's and Bessemer's methods were virtually identical, sent a Mr. Z.S. Durfee to England to look into the Englishman's work and report back. Simple enough, right?
Right, but I smell a plot complication coming.
Yes, you do. On his way back to Detroit, Durfee stopped off in Ohio, where Mr. and Mrs. Kelly were living at the time, and paid him a visit. In the course of their discussion, Durfee showed them a picture he'd bought in London of Sir Henry.
Okay, I'm with you.
Well, the interesting thing is that when William Kelly was running the Sewanee furnace in Eddyville, he hired a pair of Englishmen to work with him. They were incredibly supportive and very, very observant. Right up until the night, they disappeared.
Wait a minute. Disappeared?
Yep, just vanished. They even left their paychecks behind.
Got it. So they were aliens, right?
Oh, not even close. Kelly broke out the bloodhounds and tracked them to the Eddyville Wharf, then to Cincinnati, and then to New York, where you found out that they'd hopped a steamship back to England.
Okay, I got it. William Kelly recognized Sir Henry Bessemer as one of the two Englishmen.
Exactly. As the story goes, Kelly leapt to his feet and exclaimed, "My lord, Mr. Durfee, this is a picture of the Englishman who helped me with my experiments at the Sewanee Ironworks."
So why didn't he do anything about that?
Boucher writes that Kelly was more than a little embarrassed to be taken advantage of like that, and frankly, he was broke. He simply couldn't afford to press his case in the United Kingdom, and above all, he couldn't really prove it.
Well, this begs the question of whether or not Bessemer would have done anything like that.
It does.
Well, I asked Dr. Susan Mossman about that very thing, and she explained that Sir Henry wasn't above a little good old-fashioned industrial espionage.
He does recount where he goes to Germany on a trip with a friend and near Nuremberg. And in fact, Nuremberg in Germany are the place where they were producing this very fine gold powder for gilding. And that was the process that he circumvented with his own process. And he was arrested for industrial espionage and then told by the judge, well, if I were you, I'd go tomorrow, otherwise there'll be a mob after you. And it was interesting to me that he went to Germany. And I know he reports in his book about spies from other people trying to actually find out about his processes. So I think it's going on, or people are trying to find out about other people's business. But I certainly don't know of that. But again, if there was any more evidence of that, and if anybody could have cast any more light on it, absolutely fascinating.
Wow. Well, he would have had the motive and could very well have had the opportunity.
But he may not have had the means.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, back in the 1840s and 1850s, there was only one way to get from England to America. That was by ship.
So?
Well, Bessemer got seasick. Here's Dr. Mossman.
He'd suffered from seasickness all his life. He invented this sort of self-tilting boat, and that was towards the end of his life. And I think probably, he wouldn't admit it, that was probably only failure, because I think the sort of tilting saloon in the ship actually made the boat go off balance, and it kept on crashing into Calais Harbour when they were trying it out near France.
Ah, now that is a problem. Still doesn't mean he didn't come here.
No, it doesn't. It just would have been, well, unpleasant. But on the other hand, from how Dr. Mossman describes Henry Bessemer, if he wanted to make that two-week transatlantic trip, he would have done it green in the gills.
He didn't get enormous recognition from the British establishment till the 1860s. Because he literally at that point wrote to the government, he wrote to the Prime Minister, he wrote, published the letter in the Times about how he hadn't got recognition for something he'd done, an invention for the post office something like 30 years before. And it was really interesting that after he wrote this, in the same year, he got a knighthood, he got made a fellow of the Royal Society, and following on from that, he became, a fellow or introduced into the various, our guilds, our livery guilds, were specialist companies, anything from cutlers to engineers, etc. It seems that he really got a lot of public acclaim at that point. He'd made the money. So he was a rich, wealthy man, and he talks earlier about wanting to live a life of luxury. So that was one of his specified aims when he was a young man. And he managed to do that because he then built himself this extraordinary house. And you see the pictures of it in Denmark Hill in London, and it's completely been taken away now. I mean, only some of the walls remain. But it was this luxurious house with marble floors, with this extraordinary conservatory. And the clock that he had, an ornamental clock, which is currently in the offices of the Institute of Materials in London, Materials and Minerals and Mining in London, that's an extraordinary piece. It's sort of high Victoriana, you know, over the top Victoriana. I mean, so he certainly was, he knew how to spend his money, and he took a great interest in how his house was built and decorated. So it's, you know, he really had an aim. He wanted to make money, but he was also always interested in inventions.
William Kelly, on the other hand, didn't do so well.
No, he did not. And Lyon County historian Odell Walker tells us why.
He was devoting all of his attention to his experimenting and wasn't paying too close attention to his financial situation. And I believe I'm right that long about that time they had what they called a panic, which we call a depression now, which hit him pretty hard.
So hard, in fact, he was forced to sell his patent. Later that year, both his and Bessemer's patents were licensed by Cambria Ironworks, which was later sold to Midvale Steel in 1916, and sold again to Bethlehem Steel in 1923. Kelly only ever got 5% of the royalties Bessemer got, and because the Englishman was more famous, the process was named for Bessemer.
So he ended up making axes and working in real estate in Louisville, Kentucky, where he died in obscurity on February 11, 1898.
Today, Kelly's New Union Forge is under the waters of Lake Barkley near Catawba. The Sewanee Furnace, where he made his discoveries, lies in ruins. And that seems like it's such a sad way to go. All his intelligence, all his hard work, all that time and energy, and nothing. I mean, you have to wonder if he had any idea of what he made possible. Maybe not, but the problem is, neither did anybody else. Again, Odell Walker.
I would say if you went down the streets in Catawba, anywhere in Lyon County, and ask about William Kelly, 97% of them would tell you didn't know anything about him. And 3 or 4%, 5 might say, well, yeah, I've heard of him. But it's just been too long, and it's been too many generations have come and gone.
Not to worry, Todd. This is in no way the end of the story. It'll take a while, but Kelly does get his recognition, and all thanks to one very enthusiastic Murray State chemistry professor, a group of Lyon Countyans who are very passionate about their history, and a lot of hard work, claiming Kelly's legacy when Western Kentucky, a birthplace of steel, comes back.
Once I built a railroad, I made it run. Made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun.
Welcome back to Western Kentucky, a birthplace of steel. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton.
So here we are now, more than 125 years since William Kelly died in relative obscurity.
And in the intervening century and a quarter, nothing much has changed in that regard.
Especially if you ask people in Western Kentucky, who is William Kelly?
I have no idea.
No, I do not.
No, I do not.
No, I do not know who that is.
I have no idea who William Kelly is.
Those were all Western Kentucky residents Matt Johnson, Hannah Robbins, Chris Porter, Jordan Rutzel, and Linda Moore. But the name of Kelly's British counterpart is still synonymous with the steel industry. People still know who he is. Dr. Susan Mossman.
Strangely enough, apart from his Bessemer process, certainly in London there is a Bessemer Road. But I think people just remember him because of his great, great contribution to the history of and development of steelmaking and in the Industrial Revolution. But I think perhaps he gets more praise and appreciation abroad than in his own country.
That praise abroad leads all the way back to Alabama, where we find a town named for Sir Henry.
And while there are many towns in the U.S. named Kelly, they aren't named for our Kelly, the Western Kentucky steel man.
But all hope is not lost for bringing William Kelly's name back to relative prominence.
My name's Keith Lindblom, and I am the manager of the National Historic Chemical Landmarks Program.
The American Chemical Society dates back to 1876 and has more than 150,000 members. One of the many ACS programs is the NHCL.
All nominations have to meet 3 criteria in order to be approved. They've got to be more than 25 years in age. They have to be seminal science, so something really original in the field of chemistry. And they have to evidence a significant impact on or benefit to society.
You can find these landmarks in 31 states, and they celebrate the invention or discovery of things like oxygen, penicillin, scotch tape, and the instant photograph, otherwise known as a Polaroid.
Now that's a sound I haven't heard in a while.
Dr. Bill Oliver is a Western Kentucky native and now a retired chemistry professor. He's an ACS member and serves on the subcommittee responsible for approving these landmarks. He takes us back to where the effort to get Kelly his deserved recognition all started.
I was giving a paper in November 2013, and the topic of my paper was National Historic Chemical Landmarks in the South. So I covered the landmarks that were in the 14 southern states, went over them, and I noted during my talk that I was unhappy that there had been no landmark in Kentucky, but I hadn't been able to think of any, and no one else had either. But sitting in my audience was Dr. Don Hicks, who had been my chemistry professor at Murray State, and he mentioned to me the work of William Kelly, and I was vaguely familiar with the iron ore production between the rivers in the 19th century, but did not connect that to William Kelly and what he had done. But Dr. Hicks did.
Dr. Oliver and Dr. Hicks are both Kentucky natives, and they were very keen on making this happen. So what do? They call on one man to lead the charge. And who is this man, you ask?
Dr. Logan Nathan.
Dr. Bomana Logan Nathan.
Dr. Logan.
Dr. Bomana Logan Nathan.
Bomana Logan Nathan, professor of chemistry at Murray State University. Usually people call me Logan, so Logan is fine.
Logan is from India. He's energetic with an easy 1,000-watt smile.
I'm a researcher and teacher. As a researcher, we have to have the passion for things we are doing it. So I can feel how William Kelly was so passionate about his work and created and developed a new method to convert iron to steel. So that kind of passion I can really relate.
And he put his passion to work right away. He combed through stacks of local historical records and patent information to compile the nomination for Kelly's National Historic Chemical Landmark. After 7 months of research, Loganathan submitted the nomination. And then, on May 11th, 2015, under an appropriately blue and steel gray sky in Lyon County, it paid off.
Representatives of Lyon County government, the Lyon County Historical Society, and Kentucky State Supreme Court Justice Bill Cunningham, along with historian Odell Walker, joined members of the American Chemical Society and around 100 Lyon Countyans to unveil the plaque honoring William Kelly.
And the hardworking, unassuming chemistry professor who helped make this happen.
I know everyone here joins me today in hoping that Dr. Logan Nathan gets through all of this without dying of terminal enthusiasm. Be calm.
Well, Chad, I attended the Lyon County ceremony, and when I caught up with Dr. Logan Nathan and Mr. Walker afterwards, I could see what Dr. Oliver meant.
I just want to know, you made it. How do you feel?
It's amazing, wonderful feeling. I'm so honored to have this opportunity to nominate and make this happen.
It's nice to see the hard work finally pay off.
Thank you so much.
And Odell Walker was just as gratified, if a little more restrained.
It's been a great day for me. Ever since I started doing historical research on William Kelly, I came to the conclusion that he had not been honored for his contribution to the world. And this is just the culmination of an activity I've longed to see for many years.
It was the finish line for them, the culmination of a lot of time and a lot of hard work.
And if you still need convincing that Kelly's contribution is important, crucial even, Dr. George Bodner of the ACS sums it up and points out one of the best,
for our region at least,
unintended consequences of Kelly's work.
The key to remember about William Kelly is in the absence of his particular step in the process, the Bessemer process would not have occurred. The second thing we have to really recognize about Kelly is that in the absence of his contribution, many of the trees in this vicinity would no longer exist. It was partially the denuding of the forest that motivated him to look for a fuel source that was not the equivalent of wood. And so this notion of blowing air through the system to burn the carbon out and thereby heating it, the mixture, so that you don't need an external fuel, was a fundamental step towards what eventually then became known as the Bessemer process.
That's amazing. So a lot of the trees in LBL today just wouldn't be there if Kelly hadn't decided to look for a more efficient way to fuel his process.
That's right.
All things considered, Chad, how could anyone think Kelly didn't deserve this? I can't imagine the ACS debating this very much, if at all.
But that's where you'd be wrong, Todd.
Really?
Yep, so says Dr. Oliver.
Oh, sure, there's always debate. There are people who think that Bessemer's contributions are more important. There are people who think Kelly's are, and then there's the committee sifted through all of that. And you can debate it all you want. The dates speak for themselves. Kelly did this. It was recognized. He had plenty of witnesses. The patent court in the U.S. recognized it. But the committee went through all of that and debated it very vigorously. But at the end, it was a unanimous choice after we had debated it for an hour or so.
Then I think we need to know if this is unusual.
Well, that's where Keith Lindblom comes in. He's the manager for the National Historic Chemical Landmark Program for the ACS, and I asked him that very question.
Does tension ever surround some of these nominations?
Well, nominations can certainly be debated. I wouldn't say that it's tension, but for example, in the case of Rachel Carson, her work is not really chemical in nature, and so there was some hesitancy to making her work a National Historic Chemical Landmark. Rachel Carson being the author of Silent Spring, which was a very influential book, which many people credit for the rise of environmentalism in the 1960s and even the forming of the Environmental Protection Agency. But that nomination was ultimately approved because the Landmark Subcommittee and Public Affairs and Public Relations agreed that the impacts of her work on chemistry were significant and met the criteria.
Was there any tension or debate over this landmark?
The Landmark Subcommittee always vets nominations thoroughly, and so they did extensive research through the literature in the history of science community, looked through the patents, and because William Kelly holds the patent for this process in the United States, it's very difficult to debate those merits.
And it's certainly something Dr. George Bodner isn't arguing with.
In the absence of this, we would have had trouble. So the railroads would not have been built as rapidly, or we would have to have been constantly replacing the railroads, because they wouldn't be hard enough, steel being significantly harder than iron. So the net result is that the industrialization of the U.S. was driven by the steelmaking industry. And what Kelly did was a seminal part of the growth of that industry. One of the things that historians of science will ask, and I dabble in this, is, if it hadn't been Kelly, would someone else have developed the idea at roughly the same time? And the answer is, at some point, someone would have made the observation. But the key was that Kelly was willing to do it. He was willing to spend the time. He was willing to appear crazy, you know, to his family, his workers, and so forth, to get a process going that he knew would work. And it did work. There are examples of this throughout the history of science, of people who were told they were crazy. And then we've now incorporated their craziness into our knowledge of the nature of the world in which we live. So Kelly's work was seminal.
Hold on. So Kelly was willing to appear crazy.
Right.
And people thought he was.
Yep.
But as we heard earlier from Dr. Mark Moseley, it was physician George Huggins who said he was sane.
Right.
So what does Dr. Moseley think of that?
Let's find out.
I believe the old doctor, in his way, contributed a nice medical boost to letting this area be a contributing force in the metallurgy of America, you know. There's lots of great history in this area.
All right. Change the plaque. Dr. George Huggins. Sorry, Dr. Loganathan. I apologize, and we'll be talking to the American Chemical Society
about this. No. We're kidding. We are kidding. You know, Chad, something Dr. Bodner said earlier about the rails reminds me of a line from the song The City of New Orleans about the sons of Pullman porters and the sons of engineers riding their father's magic carpets made of steel. I mean, the way of making steel more efficiently and of a consistent quality was really transformative. So the work speaks for itself.
It's like you said at the beginning of the hour, Todd, we use steel so much, and so many of those things were necessary to get us where we are. How much longer would it have taken for the United States to expand west without strong rails?
Well, the first skyscraper was built in Chicago, Illinois in 1884. How long would we have waited for this particular innovation if there hadn't been the technology to build it?
And I think we can say that industry around the world really wouldn't be where it is, bringing us so many of the things that we use today, day in and day out, were it not for Kelly's pioneering of that process.
But that, you know, that's the funny thing about innovation. It's not necessarily about inventing the wheel, for example. It's about taking that wheel, putting it on the end of a stick, adding another wheel at the other end, putting some boards on the stick, and hey presto, you have a wagon. That's basically what William Kelly did. He didn't invent steel, but his ideas made steel a more viable material with which to build our modern world. But you know what, Chad?
What?
I think there's a better way to put this. Part of the Lyon County dedication ceremony was a high school poetry contest. Students wrote verses about Kelly and what he accomplished. They had two massive easels covered with these illustrated poems, and the one that struck me the most was this one, written by Courtney Bowes, a senior at Lyon County High School. Something powerful, hot and cold, formable, wieldable. Someone great, William Kelly. A flicker of light, a leap of smoke, and steel is made for our world.
This has been Western Kentucky, a birthplace of steel. We'd like to thank the American Chemical Society, the Lyon County Historical Society, and Murray State University's Pogue Library.
And we'd like to thank our contributing producers, Rob Canning, Allison Crawford, Whitney Jones, and Kate Lochte.
We'd also like to thank Dr. Susan Mossman and the Science Museum of London,
Dr. Rusty Jones, Dr. David Canning, and David Shelton.
And we have a very special thanks to Mr. Odell Walker and
Bomana Logan Nathan. Usually people call me Logan, so Logan is fine.
I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Thanks for listening.